is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Thursday morning. Hello, Dr. Carl.
Hello, Dr. Zan. How are you today?
Great. How are you?
I'm wonderful. My wife was having a shower the other day and she said, look, there's dolphins out there.
You're always, spotting the dolphins and the whales from your bedroom window.
This is a bathroom window.
Oh, sorry.
But they're out there, you see.
I can see the local fire station from my window.
But even if you look up, like I've had this experience of walking on the beach and I say to people, look at the sky, there's a rainbow around it. And there is. And they won't look up as though when they're looking up, I'll steal their swim clothes.
You're not to be trusted.
I mean, people should just look around the world around them.
Yeah. Looking up in the sky is a really good experience.
Well, on two consecutive Easter Sundays, about 5 years ago, I saw three suns in the sky.
How?
Well, they were sun dogs at 22 degrees off to one side. So I was looking in the sky and I could see one sun, and then 22 degrees off to one side, 22 degrees off the other side, I could see another sun. It was just high-altitude ice crystals that were bending, catching the light and bending it back to give an image, and unusually still air so that it was roughly like a big globe. And this happened on two consecutive Easter Sundays.
Look around you.
You look around, man. See the life. Smell the roses, man.
Well, particularly now because it's autumn, one of my favourite seasons, and it's so pretty.
And there's these weird flowers like the mock oranges that smell so sweet.
We're getting so emo all of a sudden, Dr. Carl.
Does that mean I have to wear black and be depressed?
Just be autumnal. Okay. Hey, should we invite some other people to be part of our conversation this morning?
Yeah. By the way, what do the Americans use instead of autumnal?
Fallful?
Fallful?
No, I don't know.
I don't know. It's
called fall. Always got to figure that out. Hey, do you want to ask us a question? Please do. Otherwise, we'll just keep on rabbiting on.
Yes.
1-300-055-36 is the number to buzz. If you've got an answer and you can't get through, then you can let us know a couple of ways on the text line, 1975-7555, or at Dr. Carl Direct. He's on Twitter, DocTorKarl. First caller for this morning is Morgan in Gordon. Hi, Morgan.
Hello.
And Gordon.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's your question?
Got a bit of a weird one. So we've got three kinds of cones in our eyes, right? We've got red, green, and blue. Red's the longest wavelength, blue's the shortest wavelength. We can't see wavelengths longer than red, but we can see shorter than blue, violet. We can see the colour violet, but we don't have any cones in our eyes that are sensitive to violet. So how can we see the colour violet?
Because of scatter. Now, is violet just a pure colour by itself, or is further down at how many nanometers?
Like 405, I think.
Okay, so just to give some numbers to the audience, sorry to do this to you, but the visible band extends from 400 to 700 nanometers. That's the wavelength of lights, and a nanometer is a billionth of a metre. The blue cones have their peak sensitivity at 440 nanometers, but they can still get something further down. They're not picking up a lot. And there's a combination of what they pick up plus the tail end of the greens, I guess, that in your brain coalesce to give you these colours. And by the way, the number of colours we have seems to be a cultural thing. What are those birds in the background?
Yeah, I'm in a train station.
Of course,
happiest train station in the world.
They're train birds, of course. Everybody knows that.
I love train birds.
Yeah, they're my friendlies. So in our society, we're big on seven. So there's 7 days of the week, seven sins. I do like having seven sins. They're nice. Seven planets, etc. Other societies have I've seen them go from four colours up to several hundred colours that they normally recognise. That's really rare to have several hundred. Normally, it's somewhere between four and a couple of dozen. So we can see violet. It's there, and it's just a mixture of the inputs on the green sensitive cones at 540 nanometers, and the blue sensitive cones at 440.
Hey, does that make sense, Morgan?
Yeah, that sort of makes sense, yeah.
Do you have a train to catch? I heard the announcement.
No, that's the train going the other way.
Okay. Well, good luck on the train ride and enjoy the train birds.
Yeah, the train birds. In fact, I like the railway stations best where they give you the upcoming trains by interpretive dance, where the crew come out and then do a dance for you.
You live in a place where you can see whales from your window. Yeah. People do interpretive dance at your train station. It's fancy land. Hey, thanks, Morgan.
Thank you, Dr. Morgan.
See you later. Luke's calling in from Newcastle this morning. Hi, Luke.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question about detoxing. I got recommended to do like this sort of sea salt detox where you mix a bit of salt and water and go straight through you. But there's a difference between sea salt and normal salt, apparently. You can't use normal salt. My question is, why use sea salt? Yeah, I guess that's it.
Okay, and why do you need a detox? Why have you been told that you need a detox?
Well, just because I'm a really unhealthy person.
In what way are you unhealthy?
Smoke, drink, eat unhealthy foods and stuff like that.
Are you still smoking and drinking?
Yeah. I just put down a cigarette, actually.
Well, wouldn't it be better to not smoke and not drink
rather than
to take large quantities of salt, which is bad for your blood pressure?
Okay, so your advice is don't smoke and drink.
Don't smoke, don't drink, and definitely don't do the salt thing. Now, you read the books on the detox diets, and some of them are saying that you have to align your kundalinis and your chakras by having large quantities of expensive salt that they'll sell you. Okay, that's crap. But the other sort of detox that says, hey, if you drink and smoke too much, maybe don't for a while. Well, that's common sense.
So it is common sense. I mean, I have tried the diet where you go 3 days without eating anything, and I was that was my next question. If I have time, is what's the best kind of diet? I mean, I tried the lemon detox diets. I think it's BS. And
okay, look, I'm going to mention a book called by Michael Pollan called what is it?
The Omnivore's Dilemma. Is that it?
He wrote another one which basically says seven words: eat food, comma. And food has to be something that's recognisable as food, not something that's blister packed, vacuum cleaned and sprayed with microwaves or whatever. Eat food, comma, mostly vegetables, comma, not too much.
Okay.
Maybe it's the botany of desire. Anyway, it's one of those books. And just follow what he says. But look, just eat food, comma, mostly vegetables, not too much. I'm actually writing a food book at the moment. And there's a great story about a woman who was dying of an infectious disease until she had a feces transplant from her husband. But we'll talk about that another time. So in your case, give up the smoke, give up the drinks, definitely give up the salt.
Okay.
Everything's about balance. I think extremes in any way are really bad.
Okay, so does sea salt absorb fat or does it repels fat, right?
No, what it does is it takes money from you and puts it in the wallet of the person who sold it to you. It's a con, man. It's a con.
Hey, take care of yourself, Luke. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
And remember, if you smoke, you can have erectile dysfunction problems later on.
Smoking's just generally bad, isn't it?
There's only one good thing from smoking, two good things. One is it seems to help schizophrenic people, which is
really?
We don't know why. And number two, if you have a rare sort of ulcer in your mouth called an aphthous, APHTHOUS ulcer, blow me down, the cure is tobacco.
Wow.
I know. Look, it's not all bad, but it's 99 point bunch of nines bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Ace is calling in from Penshurst. Hi, Ace.
Hi, Dr. Ace.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. No worries. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I've got a debate with a friend. We're talking about whether skin that's been sort of through trauma like sunburn can actually absorb water from the outside in and put moisture back into the skin and then avoid peeling.
Ooh. Generally, skin repels water. The reason your skin gets wrinkled after you've been in the water for a long time, is that it normally happens on the work areas where you have thick layers of dead skin, of dead keratin. I think it's alpha keratin, and hair is beta keratin. And they're not cells, they're just layers of protein, and they absorb water. When you've had a trauma to the skin, like a sunburn, the skin loses its imperviousness to water. I reckon that it would probably go in both, water could go in both directions, driven by concentration gradients. And the salts would be the things driving the concentration gradients. I don't see it as a way of getting moisture back into you if you're massively dehydrated. Water through the mouth is the best way. What I love doing on the rare occasions I get sunburned or my children get sunburned is getting sorbeline and glycerine or vitamin E cream from anyone aloe vera cream and just layering it on in layers so thick that it's white. You look like a ghost boy or girl on that part. And you just leave it and blow me down, it soaks in and you just keep on layering it in. Does it do any good? I don't know. Does it help me psychologically? Yes. So I think that your skin would become less permeable. Yeah, you know, less impervious to water, less of a barrier, but that's not a way to get... Have I answered your question?
Maybe? Well, but his theory is that after sunburn, he soaks in a bath, and I think that the water may take some of the heat out of the skin, but I'm unsure whether you're saying that the skin will absorb water.
Okay, in a sunburn, you have a thing called an inflammation, and look up Wikipedia to find out what the medical definition of inflammation is, and it's a whole bunch of things, and part of it is that the blood vessels open up and therefore they bring heat from the core to the skin, and the cooling down is good and part of the healing process. So laying in a bath of water, is it laying or lying? I've forgotten my grammar. Lie? Lay. Laying's okay. Okay. Thank you, word editor, police person in a corner. So laying down in bath is a good thing. And it's a good thing to do for burns as well.
Thanks for the call, Ace.
Thank you, Dr. Ace.
See you later. Where's Ace gone? He's just gone silent. Hey, we had Paul in Gladstone texting in about Michael Pollan.
Yes.
The name of the book you were looking for was In Defence of Food.
In Defence of Food. It's not a bad little book.
Thanks to everyone who's texting in their comments and answers on 1975 7555. Someone texted in, it's not laying, it's lying, Dr. Carl. And also Mel in Salamander Bay said, in regards to sunburn, a tepid bath with 2 litres of milk emptied in makes sunburn heaps better. I believe the lactic acid helps the repairing process.
Ah.
Jacinta from Wheelers Hill says, for sunburn, the best thing to do is use milk. Yes, the same thing. And cool chamois. Then the following day, use moisturiser with aloe vera. Never use Vaseline or anything with petroleum because it increases the severity of the burn.
Really? Is that just hating petroleum? I mean, even if the devil says that the sky is blue, it's still blue. My understanding of Vaseline was that many years ago, I remember this from reading a Reader's Digest, Cheesbury Ponds was walking through the fields where they were picking up, where they were working on the oil. And they had this oil waxy stuff that they threw away, and they kept a bucket of it, though, always in case they had wounds because it healed wounds really quickly. And from that, we got Vaseline. And he used to actually have some on a piece of bread every day.
Interesting.
In Lifter 92.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's good or bad, and I'm not mentioning, I now am officially unmentioning that commercial product that I mentioned.
Okay.
Because this is a government station.
That's good. So you can go back in time.
Yes.
1-300-055-536 is the number to call if you've got a question for Dr. Carl. He's here till midday today answering them for you. Elton's calling in from Mackay. Hi, Elton.
Hi, Dr. Elton.
G'day. How you going?
Great. Good. What's your question?
My question is, if I'm stranded in the desert, been there for a few days and I haven't had anything to drink, and then I stumble upon a box of beer, do I drink it or does that dehydrate me more?
Firstly, you're doing the right thing, if stranded in the desert, to not drink anything at all for the first few days, to force your kidneys and your circulatory system into a water-conserving mode.
Oh.
And I had a master plan when we were travelling through the desert with my wife, Mary, who was breastfeeding, our six-week-old daughter and our two-year-old son. And if there was a terrible accident and everybody died, what I would do is get the brains of people who died and mush them up with water and feed that to the baby in case she was still alive, because that would keep them alive. Because brains, I've read this from some Aboriginal writings, mixed up with water, have roughly the same consistency as breast milk. Getting back to the beer.
It's interesting that you think of these things before you go on a family holiday, but go on.
Well, we were off-road for a month where we didn't see another person for a whole month.
Right.
So if we lost everything, it was going to be up to us to keep ourselves alive.
Yeah.
Right. With regard to the beer, I do know that large amounts of high-octane alcohol, like, for example, 40, 50% alcohol, will dehydrate you. Beer is anything between 2 and 11% alcohol. I actually had some 11% alcohol when I was in Victoria recently, at a place called Stratford-on-Avon, which is not where Shakespeare was born, but in Victoria. And it was very nice. So, but it's mostly water, 95% water. So to answer your question, Dr. Elton, I reckon that in beer, the fact that you're drinking 95% water is going to be really good for you. And the 5% alcohol that you're drinking, I don't think it's going to dehydrate you more than the 95% water that you're drinking, but have it very slowly in small amounts. Because a little bit of beer is good, but too much is bad.
And hopefully you're never stranded in the desert. Thanks for the call, Elton.
No worries. Thank you.
See you later.
Thank you, Dr. Elton.
Dale's calling in from Wyong. Hi, Dale.
Hi, Dr. Zan. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
Hi, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Dale, welcome.
I was at a railway station early one morning, and I saw a moth scaling a wall. And every dozen steps or so, he would stop and dip his wings half a dozen times each way.
Well, hang on. So you got a moth,
yes,
and he's walking up or down or across the wall?
Going up a wall, yes.
In sunlight or not sunlight?
No, it was probably fluorescent light, I guess.
Okay, right. So he's walking along a wall, and then he walks with his little leggies, and then every how many steps?
Probably half a dozen, I'd say.
Half a dozen steps, he would...
He would stop and dip his wings each way.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, I don't think he's doing it to get rid of heat. Maybe he is. Because when he's flying, the wings are flapping and cooling him. I do not know. Maybe walking is an incredibly inefficient mode for him and he's generating localized heat that he has to cool off by flapping his wings. I don't know. If somebody can Twitter us...
An entomologist,
which is different from an entomologist, who would tell us rather about the origin of the word moth rather than stuff about the infancy.
So if you're an entomologist and you're listening, you know why moths are dipping their wings when they're having a little walk up a wall.
Yes.
Please contact us, 1300 055 536. Help Dale in Wyong out with this quandary. We'll see if we can get an answer for you, Dale.
Thank you.
See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have November on the line from Canberra. Hi, November.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning, Dr. November.
I've heard in a couple of places that a cat's purr can help mend broken bones.
Well, I've actually written a story about this in one of my books, and Charles Darwin in 1872 wrote, "The puma, cheetah and ocelot likewise purr, but the tiger, when pleased," notice the emphasis on the ED, "emits a particular short snuffle accompanied by a closure of the eyelids. It is said that the jaguar, lion and leopard do not purr." Now, when we try to purr, you make a kind of a rumble. It's not really the full thing. What happens with a cat purring? It was worked out in the early 70s by Drs. Reimer and Gautier from the Department of Psychology or Physiology at Dartmouth Medical School in New Hampshire. And they put electrodes to pick up the electrical signals coming off anywhere that there were muscles that could be involved in the airways involved in generating the purr. And what they found out was that when the cat was starting, it would suddenly close the gap almost totally between its vocal cords in its airway, almost totally close it, increasing the pressure in its airway, the trachea, by about 4 centimetres of water. I do not know why the physiologists measure pressure in centimetres of water rather than cubic furlongs per square second. Don't blame me. And then this would suddenly increase the pressure 4 times over normal, and then it would suddenly release it, and this would produce a sound which would be then maintained. The vocal cords would vibrate for about 10 to 15 milliseconds at a frequency of 150 to 200 cycles, then stop vibrating, and then after the first burst of purring, 30 to 40 milliseconds, they would then start doing it again, and they go on and off like this for 25, 35 minutes without any problem. Now, firstly, cats do not purr to show they're contented.
No.
Sure, they'll purr when they're contented, and when they're in pain or giving birth or being threatened, it's a way of communicating. Secondly, we don't know why they purr, so we don't know the purpose of a cat's purr.
Very sad that you said you would have done that.
Sorry about that. And then with regard to the claim that the cat's purr will heal, realign, strengthen your bones, organs or mental state, this is followed almost immediately by, "And you can buy my CD of purring cats," mixed in with some pseudo-scientific jargon. Now, here's a question for you, November. Mm-hmm. Did you read the words frequency or quantum?
It was so long ago, I don't recall. I'm sorry.
Okay. If they use the word frequencies or quantum, you're dealing with horse feathers. They're lying at you. There is zero proof from all of the veterinarians that it helps. However, we have found with people who are getting older and who are losing their balance, people maybe a decade or so before death when things are winding down, that if you have powerful vibrations applied directly to their feet for certain periods of time during the day, that improves their balance.
Mm.
But to say that the cat's purr will make your bones heal more quickly, people have been looking at healing bones more quickly. On one hand, in bone surgery, the bone is a prince of tissues. It heals better than anything else. And every now and then, they just refuse to heal. And we don't know why. And for the best part of a century, we have tried everything. And I'm sure they would have tried cat's purrs.
Mm-hmm.
No proof.
Thanks for the call, November.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. November.
Jason's on the line from the Blue Mountains. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question is, see, I'm quite addicted to milk, and I just wanted to know what the effects was on the human body, i.e., say, cholesterol, energy, hydration, what full cream milk has on the human body.
All humans, practically all, can digest milk and break down the carbohydrate in it, which is called lactose. And they can do this with an enzyme called lactase. And they can do this so they can drink their mother's milk, or father's milk in very rare cases, but we won't talk about that now. Then, when they get to be 5, 7, 10, whatever, most humans on the planet lose this ability. However, for Caucasian white Europeanoid type people. A mutation happened about 7,000 years ago around Poland, Ukraine, where my folks come from, which enables us as adults, white Caucasian European people, a minority on the planet, but still a sizable minority, to digest milk. There are no problems with drinking milk. Milk is mostly water. It has some fat, it has some carbohydrate, and it has calcium and various other things. There's a surprising amount of calories. I haven't got my list of food values, but you can, if you drink a lot of milk, you can get a sizable amount of your daily calories, and you, because you're drinking it, you don't think you're getting it. I don't think it causes any harm for the vast majority of people.
Right, so cholesterol, it wouldn't hurt your cholesterol.
With cholesterol, it's a little bit tricky. Unfortunately, I'm one of these people who's sensitive to having cheese in the diet. So if I'm behaving like a typical French person, when I went there, I gloried in a country which is so civilized that they got 4,000 different types of cheese.
So good.
Oh, so good. But I'm one of these people who, unfortunately, if I have lots of fats in my diet, my cholesterol goes up. So therefore, I just avoid it. Most people don't have this problem. We're all different.
Cholesterol's, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It affects different people in different ways.
So I don't know what it is in your case, but in most people, it isn't a bad thing if you have moderate amounts of milk, whatever moderate is. And by the way, milk doesn't cause mucus.
If you're worried, Jason, maybe go and check your cholesterol levels with your local GP.
Mm. And we've just found, in fact, that some of the ancient mummies had high cholesterol levels, which led to blocking of their arteries several thousand years ago via CAT scans of their mummies.
Wow. Thanks for the call, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
See you later. Sandy, with you, hanging out with Dr. Carl on this Thursday morning, talking science, and someone in Colorado is listening to us in their car.
John Morgan, wait for it, is listening to us live streaming, talking about sunburn while driving towards the snow-covered Canadian Rockies.
That's awesome. Sorry, Canada, not Colorado.
Canada.
Thank you for listening and streaming. Thank you to everyone who listens to us around Australia and around the world every week. We've got a few more callers on the line. Tim in Sunbury is our next questioner. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question, Tim?
I was just wondering about the nature of mouth ulcers. Dr. Carl spoke of one specifically, and just mouth ulcers in general, ones that don't seem to be caused by just a cut or a nick in the mouth. When they can, for myself, they can come in bulk sometimes, or you get more than one, and they don't seem to be caused by anything specifically. I was wondering if there's any sorts of viral links or anything that can increase someone's rate of getting them or anything like that.
I know that you're male by your name and your voice. I don't know if you're black or white, short or tall, fat or skinny. I don't know anything about your past psychological, definitely not gynecological, but medical, surgical, pharmacological history, family history, social history. I don't even know what your skin looks like. The thing to do is to see your doctor, and then there would be four dozen different types of ulcers. And to run through each of those would take hours. So just check it out with your local GP, and that would be the best way to go.
Hey, thanks for the call, Krellen. Sorry, Tim.
Tim.
I think
it was a male.
Thanks, Tim.
We're not going to change your gender. We won't do a noodlectomy.
We're going to Krellen next on the Gold Coast. Hi, Krellen.
Hello, Krellen.
G'day, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question is, my boss's house burnt to the ground in Byron Bay, five-level house. We went there to check if we could get anything from the house, which was twisted metal, everything was burnt to the ground, and the only thing that I found was soap in perfect condition, like you could have a shower with it.
Wow.
I was just wondering, is the ingredient in soap or something?
Where was this soap? Was it out in the open in where the bathrooms would have been, or was it in packets in a cupboard, or?
There was two forms of soap I found. One was like a liquid thing in an ice cream container, and it was still liquid, and the ice cream container was fine. And the soap, yeah, it was clean as. And, I mean, everything was burnt to the ground.
But did you see bars of soap, or was it just the liquid soap?
A liquid soap and a bar of soap, both.
A bar of soap? Was the bar of soap in wrapping, or was it where the bathroom would have been out in the open?
No, it wasn't in wrapping. It was just clear. It was just the soap.
Look, I don't know, but we've got, I think, enough information. What I'm thinking of is something like evaporation. If you want to turn, I'm going to use the old currency nowadays, if you want to get 1 gram of water and heat that by one centigrade degree, you need a unit of energy called a calorie. This is easy. It's ancient units, but it makes sense. So to heat 1 gram of water by 1 degree is 1 calorie. To heat it from naught up to 100 degrees is 100 calories. Makes sense. But then to turn it from water at 100 to steam at 100 is another 540 calories. So we can soak up a huge amount of heat just in changing state. And so maybe it was wet, and so it evaporated off and bubbled off the surface. I don't know, and if somebody could ring in or give us an answer on DOCTORKARL on Twitter, or the magic number here on Triple J.
1975-7555 on the text line.
We would be very happy to see that.
Yeah,
is that
it's
a
bizarre.
Prime number? No, it's not a prime number because it's divisible by 5. What is the number again? 1975-7555. It's definitely not prime because it's divisible.
I'll just let you sort that out
it
over
must
there.
Be something special.
Hey, Krell, we're going to try and get you an answer before the morning is out. Thanks for the call.
Can I give a shout out to my mate travelling around Australia?
I think you just did. What are their names?
Josh.
Hi, Josh.
Josh.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Krellin.
Thank you.
We've got Ryan from Cloncurry on the line. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Dr. Ryan.
Hey,
welcome.
Hey, Dr. Carl, Dr. Zen, how are you?
Good morning.
Morning. My question for you is, lately me and my mates have been travelling back from Indonesia on a midnight flight, and we'll be sitting in the seat and that, and like you sort of get a big gas build up in your tummy like you have to go to the toilet and do a poo, but you'll go there and absolutely nothing will come out, just gas. I'm wondering why that is.
Well, a few reasons. Now, the first thing, my favourite body part or organ is the uterus, my second favourite body part is the anal sphincter, because it can hold in gas. It can release gas while holding in the solids and liquids. So you don't have a wet fart, as we call it in the trade.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right? And that's an amazing thing it can do. Secondly, it's well known among the military that being at the higher altitude reduces the pressure on the outside of the body. Your guts are still generating gas at the same rate, half a litre a day for the average person, 14 farts per day for men, slightly fewer for female, except they're 20% larger in volume because the pressure is 20% lower.
Right.
So you've got. So if you take a sealed bag of chips with you onto the plane, what would we call it for Americans? Because French fries, is it?
No, chips.
They know what chips are.
Crisps? No, that's UK. I'm not sure. I can't remember right now.
Okay, so depending on where in the world, if you take and a packet is sort of loose, it's a bit, it's full of sealed, and you take it on the airplane, as the plane climbs, it becomes really tight and tense and swollen, and that's what's happening to the gases in your gut. So that's why you're feeling the extra pressure.
Yeah, right. Excellent.
Thanks for the call, Ryan.
Can I give a shout-out quickly?
To my best friend. Just did.
Go ahead.
Her name is...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Quick.
Okay. Yeah, just give a shout-out to all 402, Terek Seismic, going to Alice Springs.
All right.
Yeah, love 402.
Done.
Yeah, love
it's a shout-out morning, isn't it?
Never liked
thanks,
402.
Ryan.
402 is great.
Carwin's calling in from the Gold Coast. Carwin, have you got anyone you want to shout-out to this morning?
Please. No, I don't actually.
Awesome. You've got a science question for us. Hit us.
Hit us, man.
It's about the, I read somewhere about 2 months ago about horoscopes all going back a month, something to do with we haven't added on the star constellations moving every 2,000 years or whatever, 1,000 years or something.
That's right.
I'm just going to look up the link then, but it's something to do with we haven't added on time or something to horoscopes and we're all supposed to go one back now.
You didn't read my 24th book. That's a problem. Now, there's general astrology, which looks how humanity is affected by significant, whatever they are, alignments of the stars and the planets. There's a thing called genethiology, which is the branch that looks at your life based on the positions of the stars and the planets at the exact moment of your birth. And if you talk to anybody who's ever been involved in giving birth or being part of the team, what is the exact moment of birth? It can vary by half an hour. What the head, the feces, the uterus, the placenta, which bit? Okay. And then there's catarchic astrology, tries to find the most auspicious time to start a task. Now, this whole thing about how stars can express the divine will of the gods goes back 2,300 years ago to the Babylonians. They divided the sky into 12 slices because they had a numbering system devised on 12. And there are advantages to 12. So you had the 12 slices of the sky, the 12 houses, the Aries, the Pisces, the Aquarius. But the Earth spins on its own axis, but it's like a top slowly sweeping out a circle. And in the last 2,000 years, it's shifted. It shifted by a whole house. It shifts by 1 degree every 72 years. And so the people who are still using the old house numbering system They've been wrong. And a guy called Hipparchus, Hipparchus, he was the first one to note this back in 129 BC because he was an astronomer and he noted where the stars were and he went back to the ancient records and found there was a shift. And they could measure that stuff back then. But even today, we still believe in crap like astrology.
What's your star sign, Dr. Carl?
I'm Pisces on the cusp of Aries, and that makes me a very kind, giving person.
See, only a Pisces on the cusp of Aries would give an answer like that.
That's right.
It all makes sense.
Give. We live to give.
It all makes sense. Hey, thanks so much for the call, Carlin.
That's right. Thank you.
See you later. Dr. Carl's joining us. We're having a few texts come through as to just why that house that we're talking about, a couple of questions away before, you know, a five-story house burnt down. The only thing really left was bars of soap and some liquid soap. Yeah. Dilly says, I just took a blowtorch to some soap and it melted slowly, producing a waxy runoff. The bar didn't support the fire, so perhaps it wasn't directly affected for an extended time. Someone else texted and said the soap clearly wasn't animal fat-based, otherwise it would have gone, maybe a preservative. Daniel in Melbourne says, same theory as if you put a wet finger into very hot oil, which we do not recommend. It won't burn. The vapour forms a protective layer. So thank you to everyone with their thoughts on just why this soap was the only thing left standing in a big house fire. Interesting stuff. Mm. Hey, we've got time for a couple more questions. I promise that they won't be about wet farts either. 1300 055 536 if you want to call us. Right now we're taking your questions. Molly's on the line from Berrima. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Doctor.
Hello. What's your question, Molly?
My question is, can dogs hear music? And if they can, why don't they dance?
Oh, that's a very good question. Why don't dogs dance? And do they even hear music?
Yeah, who was that Canadian guy that we had talking about music? Somebody smart.
Yeah, he would.
Was that?
Daniel Levitin.
Yeah. Get your parents to get you on the net and look up anything about Dan Levitin, L-E-V-I-T-I-N. L-E-V-I-T-I-N. Now, firstly, dogs can definitely hear music, but do they recognise it as music? For example, if you go to a different society, say Indonesia, and listen to their gamelan orchestra, at first it sounds completely odd. So to them, they've had the culture, they've grown up in it, and for them it's just regular music, but for us it's unfamiliar. And if you're going from not just one type of human to another, but to a completely different species, they may not recognise music as we do, but I think they do. There are all these studies showing that animals, perhaps chickens in coops, perhaps animals in farmyards, respond better to having certain types of music played to them, so they're recognising something. That's one thing. The other part about why don't they dance to it, well, they're four-wheel drive and we're only two-wheel drive. And
it's harder to dance with four legs?
Maybe. You could dance. I mean, I've never seen a dog ballerina or ballet piece, but I'm sure it's possible. Didn't we, in fact, last year for Vivid Festival in Sydney, have
a concert for dogs.
A concert for dogs by the woman who did Languages of Virus and
Laurie Anderson,
and
Lou Reed.
I was a roadie for Lou Reed once. And it was all in ultrasonics that humans couldn't hear?
It was at pitches that humans couldn't hear, so it was a concert just for dogs.
And what was the response? Did the dogs dance?
I think they were interested. I don't think there was any dancing, though.
Mm, look, Molly, there's an old saying. It is not the answer that gets you the Nobel Prize. It's the question. And I reckon your question is up there with some of the best questions I've ever heard. We don't have a good answer. Keep asking questions and keep listening. We might have an answer for you by the end of the show.
Thanks so much for the call, Molly.
Thank you, Dr. Molly.
See you later.
Thank you.
Lyle's.
Bye.
See you later. Oh, I want Molly to stay. Lyle's calling in from Diamond Beach this morning. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, how are you?
Hello. You've got another animal-related question for us.
Yes, a little bit different from the last one.
Yes, hit us.
It's a two-part question related to dolphins. I was told that dolphins are the only other mammals that have sex for pleasure. And if so, could there be homosexual dolphins out there?
The champion, Molly, don't necessarily listen to this next bit. Come in about a minute. Come back in about a minute. The champions for animals having sex are the bonobos, B-O-N-O-B-O, and they use it as a exchange, like, can I have a cup of tea? Okay, but only if you. And can you move out of the way? Yeah, but only if you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And they're the closest primate to humans, aren't they?
Yeah. So with regard to other animals loving each other very much in a special way for pleasure, the bonobos are way ahead. Number two, homosexuality. I think homosexuality is found in pretty well every species of animal that can love each other very much in a special way. I don't know the percentages. That's all I've got to say.
Possible.
Possible?
Yeah. How would you measure it? You don't know.
Oh, don't know. Well, you have to go looking to see if they are gay or not. How do you recognise it? I do know that dolphins can be pretty mean to other dolphins and actually attack each other. We won't go there too far because Molly's still listening.
Okay.
So, look, Lyle, lots of animals do it.
Thanks for the call, Lyle.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle.
Okay, thank you.
See you later. I think we've got time for one more quick one. We're going to head into space. Michael in Brisbane is on the line. Hi, Michael.
G'day, doctors. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
Look, just hypothetically, say you had two spaceships on Mars 50 metres apart mm-hmm. and you wore adequate cold weather clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Could you hold your breath and run between the two without any long-term problems?
I actually wrote about this in my 27th book. Yep. But, and it's also on the ABC homepage of Dr. Carl under the Great Moments in Science question. Mm-hmm. And there have been some unfortunate experiments here on planet Earth where people were in high-altitude chambers when suddenly they lost their breathing and their breathing apparatus and they were exposed to high vacuum and they survived. So the thing to do is to not hold your breath, because as the air comes out, it'll break all sorts of stuff. It'll break your lung tissue so that when you get to the other end, you might be still alive, but you're going to die. So you blow all your air out and then you try and survive as far as long as you can. 10, 15 seconds is possible to survive in a virtual vacuum.
Fantastic.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Thanks very much.
Hey, just before we get out of here, the lovely Nick from our Triple J Music Library just emailed me and said that his dog dances to certain songs only, mainly She's a Maniac and Brother Sport by Animal Collective. So there you go. There's an experiment. If your dog dances, can you let us know either on Twitter at Dr. Carl or Triple J Mornings or text us in 1975-7555.
And even set up a YouTube channel.
Dogs dancing.
Yeah.
But only humanely. Don't make them dance. Only if they want to dance. I want to dance if She's a Maniac.
Yes.
In fact, I always want to dance if She's a Maniac. Hey, Dr. Carl, we'll see you next week, same time, same channel.
See you, Dr. Zan.